In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking to authors, podcasters and activists Sam Moore and Alex Roberts, whose recently published book, The Rise of Ecofascism, explores the characteristics of past, present and potentially future ecofascism. The risks posed to society from extreme politics on the right and the left have been rising in recent years. Even in the last week or so, a cache of information was linked via the anonymous hacking group linking Putin's regime to the financing of far-right wing groups across Europe. More evidence of the rise in far-right and fascist groups is seen in places like the UK, France, Italy, or Hungary, where political ground can become an objective. Sam and Alex's work aims to be a pragmatic guide to identify these tendencies and emerging ideas in order to be able to stop them from rising into dominant movements, which, as they evidence in the book, never deliver on the grand promises they make. They also provide a long history of how the far right have developed relationships to nature that recur in history and also are echoed today in political narratives around climate denialism and delays in ridding ourselves of the fossil fuel era that is destroying the world as we know it. Thank you for listening to Climate Gen. In the next episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Behrens on the risk of food system shocks arising from the Ukraine crisis and how this is a signal of how vulnerable our overall food system is in a worsening climate and ecological crisis. Please do subscribe on any podcast channel or back Climate Gen via Patreon to get episodes early. We also had our first Cambridge Climate Series event last week with Professor Lord Martin Rees and Professor David Keith, discussing the complexity and major issues surrounding the deployment of geoengineering. The session was moderated by students from Cambridge and covered a lot of ground, so if you're interested in geoengineering, then it is worth a watch. Thank you. Okay, Alex and Sam, it's great to speak to you. Thank you very much for taking the time. You've identified in your book three characteristics of fascism, which are sort of authoritarianism, this mass racial movement, and extrajudicial killing. And you give a fascinating history of how they interact with nature politics. Can you just start, just for almost setting a scene, really, is sort of give an example of what these forms can take?
So the important thing here is to think about the history of colonialism, which produces as the kind of founding condition for the whole of modernity. And the reason why it's important is because it produces several different things simultaneously. First of all, it produces a contact between European states, European colonial states, and various new kinds of nature that those states find difficult, nigh on impossible to control at times. Part of that nature is, of course, other human beings who must be allotted positions within that nature. They must be decided whether or not they can be killed with impunity, whether or not they can be enslaved with impunity, and so on. And so various kinds of justificatory apparatuses, various kinds of ideas, ideologies arise in order to justify what is ultimately a kind of a extremely violent project. However, that's taking place kind of within the rise of mass societies. So as colonialism produces capitalism, and as in England, for example, people are dispossessed of the land, and therefore the peasantry's relationship to nature becomes one of a kind of alienated proletariat. At the same time, we get the rise of mass societies, right? So as capitalism is developing, we get rise of mass societies. Mass societies are broadly politicized. That is, people have dense connections to each other, and they try and express those connections in the public sphere. And the public sphere is, of course, kind of emerging at the same time. It's kind of also historical objects. And so as mass societies are coming into being, sort of in the early 20th century, and what happens is that conservative movements, or indeed reactionary movements, movements of the right and the far right, suddenly start to develop the capacity to wield mass politics. So before this, broadly, mass politics had been a preserve of the left, or kind of other movements that we wouldn't have difficulty characterizing now. But in the form of fascism, the far right manages to produce a form of mass politics that can harness the power of the crowd, the mass, the workers, and so on, for deeply reactionary ends. And in the post-war period, that changes for several different reasons. First of all, obviously, fascism massively discredits itself, right? It commits the Holocaust, and therefore it kind of permanently prohibits itself from entry into politics, or seemingly permanently at the time, I think. And then we get also the neoliberal transformation in the 1970s and beyond. And neoliberalism transforms the way in which mass society organizations interact with the state. Namely, it makes them less powerful. So before, it was the case that mass society organizations in the post-war period, and even before that, were able to exert a fairly clear kind of influence over the state, and people were able to organize for changes in power. That increasingly becomes less and less and less and less and less a capacity that people really have. That's the case on the far right. It's also the case on the left as well. And therefore, we get this split. Whereas before, in fascism, these two things have been allied. There was the state on the one hand, the movement that kind of supported the state, the Nazi movement, for example, or the fascist movement that was kind of intimately connected to the state. Now these two things are separated out. And part of the stakes of the book, part of the ways in which we're thinking about the way in which the far right might move into a period defined by the crisis of climate change, is that these two things might start to come back together. In that we might get, on the one hand, a state that is more amenable to the control of mass movements on the far right and the far left. And also, importantly, with this third part of our definition, we might get a situation in which extrajudicial killing returns to the center of politics, or returns to politics as a kind of a viable strategy for attaining mass power. Whereas before, and in the contemporary period, that kind of thing is made aberrant, or made to seem like it is aberrant. I'm not saying it is aberrant. It's made to seem like it is aberrant, and characterized as kind of terroristic, random, chaotic, kind of exterior to the rest of society. The question is whether or not we will get a convergence back of these two things.
I think the point of the definition is to try and find ways in which we can kind of disrupt this as well. Like, oftentimes people, when they define fascism, they kind of give one thing that it is, and they describe this object. And it's often quite hard to, you know, get within that and think about how we can, like, prevent it from coming together or prevent it from happening. And so the idea of these three parts is, in a way, to think, right, what are the dynamics at play within this kind of phenomena, and how can we ultimately, obviously, how can we stop it from happening or and keep it from happening?
Okay, so it is, from what you're both saying, this is a might, it's not a fait accompli at the moment. And also, this book has a very pragmatic sort of, I would say, activist element to it, in as much as that you're thinking through actual interventions to prevent what is really a worst outcome. And okay, there's a couple of directions we could go, but I just want to start with almost like a contemporary symptom. In climate politics, we're seeing an interesting morphing right now of the Global Warming Policy Foundation into this net zero watch. And it has the same characteristics and the same people who 10 years ago derailed climate discourse very successfully with the whole Climategate scandal. It was taken off the news agenda, taken off the TV agenda, whatever. If they succeed again now with what they're doing by creating an imaginary energy security choice versus climate action, do you think that's one thing that brings what you're discussing closer together? It's kind of one of those things that we should be watching in that sense.
There are several different scenarios that we look at in the third section of the book. I should say, kind of very briefly, as an introduction to the book, the present is the second section, and the past is the first section. This is how time works. It's how the book works. Past, present, future. And so the third section is about the future. In that section, we give a scenario for three different possibilities that this might take. One of them is the most kind of, in some ways, like unpredictable and chaotic. It has very little to do with the thing you're discussing there. Chaotic, random violence, like bioconservative movements, people who believe that humans should stay humans and so on. It's, you know, very kind of chaotic movements. That might produce essentially a kind of a terroristic output and so on. The second movement, the second style of movement, is what we characterize as batteries, bombs, and borders. That is attempts to harness the power of global capitalism in order to achieve a combination of national security objectives and simultaneous kind of global warming kind of fighting. Right. So the batteries here, refers to lithium ion batteries. Bombs refers to interventions into other countries, and borders refers to protections between, or harder distinctions being made between, say, the kind of safe areas of the global north and the increasingly chaotic and difficult to manage life conditions in the global south. So that's one scenario. And the third scenario, which I think comes closest to the thing that you're discussing here, is what we call fossilized reaction, which is essentially an attempt by parts of the far right to get behind the organization of fossil fuel infrastructure as it currently stands. That is a re-entrenchment of fossil fuel infrastructure as a kind of a vested interest in the present. The question of exactly what form that then takes, I think, is very complicated and open. I don't think we can predict the political forms of these movements in advance. Denialism, for example, has taken the form of scientific publication. It's also taken the form of kind of semi-mass movement in America, for example, or kind of evangelical movement. It's taken the form of kind of lobbying, these quite kind of in some way grayish political forms that are less visible to the outside. So exactly what political form that will take, I think that's very up for grabs. But it's really this clear distinction between a far-right movement that is aligned with the interests of fossil capital and a far-right movement that is aligned with the interests of national security, characterized as green politics. These are the two main paths we predict that the far-right will have to basically choose between, although the example you're giving here very much seems like they are preferencing the one in which they swing behind fossil fuel infrastructure as a kind of vested interest.
Is the bombs, borders, and what was the other one?
Batteries, bombs, borders.
Yeah, that sounds like it fits much more into the sort of colonial framing as well, in terms of extending our current modus operandi, if you like.
What we're thinking about in the future is kind of seeing how current trends and current phenomena, like, for example, climate denialism, might be extended in the face of the increasingly unstable world that's going to be defined by the climate crisis as it continues for the rest of our lives. And so, you know, just going back to denialism, it's gone through like a lot of stages. There's been outright denials, been denial of human responsibility, denial that we can do anything about it, denial that there's any point of doing anything about it because, you know, we're too far gone. And now, you know, you can see it with, for example, in the oil crisis now, it's like, oh, well, we're going to cut ourselves off from Russian gas and oil. So therefore, we need to open up new infrastructure in the North Sea. Therefore, we need to invest in fracking again. It's just another kind of denialism, which tries to get around the main problem, which is burning fossil fuels, and this kind of infrastructure is the thing that is careening the world into more and more chaos.
Okay.
Yeah, just to kind of give a kind of name to all of the things that Alex is mentioning there. There's trend denialism, attribution. So trend denialism, not the world's not warming up. Attribution denialism, it's not humans. Impact denialism, doesn't matter. Urgency denialism, it matters, but not now. And then there are several other ways we go into the book. We kind of extend this slightly more about different ways people might also use forms of denialism.
Okay. And I'm sure that all of those are pretty recognizable once you start sort of meditating on them a little bit.
Yes.
This kind of denial, doomerism, fatalism kind of framing is very persuasive. And I think one of the things I wanted to bring up, because that is something I've started to realize, is a growing cynicism. And I think it's almost the first stage of entering into this. It's very disempowering. And I just wanted to see if, because your book is a sort of pragmatic book in that sense, can you see a pathway to counter this cynicism and almost move it into a more activist framing that you're working towards?
So cynicism is a very difficult problem. In some ways, cynicism, or even kind of nihilism, are, as I often refer to this book, so if people are coming to our podcast, apologies for the repeated reference to Wendy Brown's book, In the Ruins of Neoliberalism, where she discusses nihilism as a kind of foundational condition of our age. People are prone to certain kinds of rejections of that anything matters. And I think climate change is one of those things that allows, because of its scope and its scale, as you're alluding to, this nihilistic attitude to seem compelling in some ways. The question of how we counter that nihilism, I think it's very complicated. Unfortunately so, because of course we need simple slogans, we need simple kinds of ways of thinking about what it is like, to put it kind of slightly bombastically, be on the earth as it is ending, right? Like that's assuming everything goes very badly. That is the kind of the stakes of our current era. Exactly how we frame that and maintain a commitment to liberatory politics or maintain a commitment to emancipatory politics is something that we discuss in the very last section of the book, the conclusion, where we discuss the need for two things simultaneously. One is the practice of solidarity. That is a sense that we have relations to other people, and this includes both people and the natural environment, that are constitutive of ourselves. So it's not a kind of a charity or altruism, but it is a recognition of the fact that our humanity, our individual capacity to be humans, relies on vast distributed systems that span the entire globe. And it's simultaneously a recognition of that, and that the current social conditions under which we live, late capitalism, constructs the planet in such a way as to make different points within this system fundamentally contradictory with each other. That is, it is not just that we can have kind of solidarity with other people, but we are made to be opposed to them. And to be very sensitive and particular about how we understand the whole of the history of the way in which that contradiction between me and someone else has been constructed will take a kind of enormous effort of sensitivity and will. The fortunate thing, in some sense, for thinking about the kind of the stakes of it, is that it's really the only thing to be doing. There are very few other things that are nearly of great importance. It's very difficult to work out what else you would do on a planet that, as I put it earlier, is kind of ending. So I think a combination of kind of notions of solidarity that need to be expanded, and also simultaneously an expanded idea of what nature entails and how we exist through and in nature. And this is the more thorny part of it, because as we narrate in the book, the far right also has its stories about nature, but it has very parochial stories about nature. It has very limited stories about nature that assert various aspects. For example, that racialization is kind of predominant within nature, whereas in fact this is a nonsensical concept from the point of view of nature.
I do agree with a lot of what Sam said, but you know, there's a certain amount of crisis with that we are locked into, and I'm working my way through the new recent IPCC report and finding it very distressing. But you know, our political responses, our human responses to that crisis, are definitely not locked in. They're very much up for contestation, I think it's there that we need to find our kind of hope and find our drive to make changes. In that, you know, there is not an inevitability to an increasingly militarized border regime. There isn't an inevitability to consigning certain parts of the world to to chaos and instability. Like, these things are political choices made by people who do still feel political pressure, and it's there where we need to be focusing our efforts. You know, there is a lot of, despite the degradation of environmental systems, there is still the capacity to feed the world. You know, that is also another political choice that people are making, and so it's there where movements can have effects, like very real and significant effects.
Yeah, I was pleased to see solidarity in the conclusion, because it's a word that I'm starting to use it more myself when thinking in a more global context, and it seems to have arisen out of movements like Extinction Rebellion or Fridays for Future that have grown up and have reached. They've got a very good sort of diplomatic network that extends around the world and has shown sort of two sort of aspirations towards a more justice-focused activism.
Can I say one thing about the justice, which is that there is a particular inflection point that we can discuss? So it used to be the case before what's called Warren County, it was a dispute in Warren County in the US, which concerned the dumping of toxic waste in a largely African-American community in the US. And the reason why this was able to be done was because of institutional racism, obviously. But the reason why it was also able to be done was because people weren't forced to pay the price of cleaning up the toxic waste, of disposing with it in a more practical way. And so what the dispute showed in the African-American community in Warren County was able to get the toxic waste removed eventually and force the company to clean it up and not simply dump it where they were. It showed that there was an alliance between, and indeed a convergence between, on the one hand, matters of justice, social settlement, and simultaneously matters of sustainability. If there had not been the justice, if there had not been this demand that waste be cleaned up, then the waste would not have been cleaned up. And therefore, sustainability or eco-friendliness and justice, in this particular example, come to be aligned more and more and more and more and more. And so there's a great phrase that Andreas Malm and Zeki Collective use in their book, Black Fuel, White Skin, which is that this shows that justice is not the enemy, but the essence of sustainability. And really kind of from that point onwards, there is more and more integration of justice into the framework of climate change, and long may it continue.
And justifying that also helps the case for solidarity, if you like.
Exactly right, yes.
It kind of feeds back in. Yeah, and the other thing where solidarity, I think, really again comes into play is with the rise of Malthusian sort of arguments around population. And again, they appear from previous interviews I've done to be completely misplaced, because dynamics of population and things like that are showing themselves to be far different than this idea that it's us against them. And it's this whole thing about stopping migrants entering Europe really is the opposite. We should be welcoming them in and absorbing them into our culture. Do you think that this, as a symptom, kind of represents one of the main front lines at the moment for defining this kind of politics of climate and for compassion in a way?
Well, yeah, I do. And I think it's also, it's a kind of racialized Malthusianism as well, because when people talk about overcrowding, they're very not very often talking about the UK or the US. They're not talking about the parts of the world where people are living in such energy-intensive lives. They're talking about people in the global south. And so we need to acknowledge that whenever we're discussing this kind of Malthusianism, this argument about overpopulation, it's always a racialized argument as well. There's no kind of like neutral way, I think, of invoking this. And as you said, the migrant crisis in commas from 2015 was not a crisis of people coming into Europe. It was a crisis of capacity and political will to accept these people. You know, in the initial stages, there were scenes of people clapping as migrants arrived in Germany, and very quickly was dispelled. This kind of Malthusianism is also kind of present, you know, across not just the centre, but also well into the fascist far right as well. And we see it a lot invoked in kind of eco-fascist circles as well. For them, they have no qualms about racializing overpopulation. I think as we see this kind of concept move through the political spectrum, a certain kind of racialization gets de-emphasized, but it is still there.
I think there's one other thing to say about this, which is there's a distinction between Malthusianism and neo-Malthusianism. And Malthusianism is based on a distinction between a civilized country that, you know, to put it bluntly, is capable of stopping having sex, right? Is capable of controlling its kind of sexual desire and therefore not having so many children. This is how Malthus frames it. Malthus believes that people of color, you know, the Irish and so on, are incapable of not having children. That's his fundamental belief. And therefore, there's a problem of too little civilization producing the Malthusian conditions. People are not civilized enough, therefore they have too many children, therefore there's overpopulation, therefore there's famine, right? One thing you were getting on the far right in particular, and we might think of this as a kind of a moving marker for how much Malthusianism in general has kind of moved into the mainstream, is that we get conceptions of Malthusianism that are based on an excess of civilization. That is, people are too civilized, people are too pampered. And what we really need is a return to Darwinian conditions, quote unquote Darwinian conditions. Of course, there never are with Darwinian conditions, or rather there always are, you know, depending, you know, pick your kind of fallacy, because Darwinian conditions is not like one thing. But, you know, the most extreme examples of this are people calling, for example, for, and this is very, very fringe, even on the far right, calling for things like maternity care to be defunded. Right, because a certain number of children historically died in childcare. People still do, of course, and women died in childbirth as well. And there have been calls from parts of the far right, again, very fringe parts of the far right, even for them, for maternity care to not happen, so that this kind of, in some ways, like natural selection process of some number of women, some number of children dying during childbirth, to be kind of reinstated as kind of a natural principle. And so the question, and that's an obviously very extreme example, but there are nevertheless other ways in which people think about this problem of excess civilization. So I think that as we look when going into the future, the question is like, how will this tension between narratives of too much civilization, narratives of too little civilization play out? How the dynamics of them unfold? And you get people, for example, who often try and play it both ways. And so the question of how these kind of tensions appear in broad far-right ecological thought will be very interesting to think about in the future, and also will be a useful marker for how much far-right thinking has crept into the center of politics.
Okay, this is really to end on. And I mean, obviously, all of the things that you're discussing, you also discuss in your podcast and is in the book in much more detail. So, I mean, that's the place to go to expand on this. But is there a light, or even a glimmer of light, that you see in contemporary dire politics that could be explored and expanded upon? Is there anything you see that you think, this actually could be influenced that way, or could turn out better than we anticipate at the moment?
Yes, loads of things. I'll give a very brief answer, then Alex can come in. The movements we're talking about are maybe 100,000 people maximum. Maximum. The Fridays for Future movement is like contained tens of millions of people worldwide. There's the appalling coincidence in that on the day that the Christchurch shooter, who in some ways triggered this round of discussion of ecofascism by calling himself an ecofascist in his manifesto, on the day that he, you know, murdered 51 Muslims in New Zealand, there was also simultaneously a global coordinated effort to do a mass climate strike. People have said, you know, this shows the kind of the underbelly of, you know, the climate movement. That's nonsense. What it shows is that there was one man who had like an appalling set of ideas, who was capable of like enacting them upon the world. And there were millions of other people who believed something totally different, who believed in justice and climate restitution simultaneously. And it's the starkness of numbers that I think people should really hold on to. The things we're talking about in the book, they are quite fringe. Yes, they have a long history. yes, they have complicated relationships to contemporary politics, to denialism, to securitization, to, you know, Trump, to Bolsonaro. Those are worrying tendencies. But in its most extreme form, it's a very marginal movement. So in some ways, the book is addressed to the anxiety about ecofascism. And so, but it's not an anxiety that we should spend all our time fixating upon. But you should read the book.
Do you think there's also an element of chance in all that? Because a lot of what Trump was doing seemed to be based on opportunism. And if he had been president now, things might look very different in Ukraine, for example. And there are sort of tips and things that influence people where suddenly 100,000 people becomes a million people. Well, I think one of the reasons for being aware of a lot of the subjects you're covering is that it helps you identify them when you see them, as opposed to them going over your head or just you not being that focused. If you're aware, you can actually call it out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think this is the point. This is the point of anti-fascism, even in a time when there's not that much fascism around, and that we are in a current time when there is a lot of far right politics around. But even if there wasn't, you know, it's just as much about preventing the conditions in which, you know, a powerful far right movement comes about, as well as contesting and fighting those movements and tendencies that are already there. You know, it's preventing the conditions as well, I think. So I think that's equally important. And that's another reason why we were trying to think through these things in a kind of future way, is to kind of preclude the possibility as much as we can, because obviously we can't tell what's going to happen in the future. No one can. That would be very strange.
Okay. And Alex, did you have a glimmer of hope?
Yeah. I've got my glimmer of hope, which is, like, at least officially, giant institutions and governments and states and corporations are all pretty universally committed to a net zero policy by a date that's way too far in the future, and it's not enough. But the political trajectory is laid out there for us to push and push it further and further as much as we can. And I think crisis breeds a lot of nihilism, and crisis breeds a lot of kind of feelings of inadequacy in what we're doing, but it also breeds a lot of opportunity as well. And things can break very quickly as well. And we've seen kind of crises and political crises in the past. It takes a long buildup of pressure before there's a quick snap, and change suddenly happens very quickly. You know, change happens, like months can happen in a matter of days or something. And so I think where a lot of the focus of climate movement should be is applying that pressure and pushing that trajectory further and further and bringing it closer to us, this net zero, and beyond, of course. So I think there is, despite kind of almighty oil, fossil fuel infrastructure, this is kind of a declining, or at least out of favour, factor of capital, and we need to be applying pressure to make it even more irrelevant.
Well, I agree with that wholeheartedly. That's a very good place to finish. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Really interesting.
Thanks again for listening. If you are interested to help support this series and help expand the discussion around climate topics, then please do consider backing my channel via Patreon. It will help me produce more content, and you will also gain access to more expert interviews. It would be great to engage more with audiences too, and understand your views on these topics.